From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty with the news on This Day in Maine, Wednesday, February 19th, 2020.
This Day in Maine is made possible by the Dempsey Center, making life better for people managing the impact of cancer. Locations in Lewiston and South Portland. DempseyCenter.org.
The Maine CDC is reporting the first flu-related pediatric death this season. The child was from southern Maine, under 5 years old, and health officials say non-vaccinated. Health officials say young children are at higher risk for more serious illness and medical attention should be immediately sought when symptoms include a fever above 104 degrees or a lack of alertness. They also advise vaccination. Maine Senate President Troy Jackson wants to require state agencies and institutions to buy American products like iron and steel when contracting for construction or maintenance projects. Mal Leary says Jackson's new bill drew opposition, including from the Mills administration.
Senator Jackson, a Democrat from Allegash, says for years the federal government has had policies to give preference to goods and services from American sources. He says that same principle should be applied to goods and services paid for with state tax money. But the Mills administration testified against the bill, arguing it goes too far and may not be needed, with nearly all state contracts going to in-state providers already. Members of the State and Local Government Committee were also warned the measure could lead to retaliation by other states against Maine companies trying to compete for contracts in those states. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
The Maine Department of Labor has been awarded up to $6.2 million to help people affected by substance abuse disorders enter or re-enter the workforce. The two-year grant is expected to help nearly 700 people in the nine Maine counties most heavily affected by substance use disorder. Maine Labor Commissioner Laura Fortman says the program's designed to help people learn skills to get good-paying jobs in high-demand occupations.
And then we will also be helping workers in those counties who are interested in working in as treatment professionals in those fields.
Fortman says the first phase of the program will be to hire around 20 peer support workers who will be the first points of contact for people considering taking part in the programs. Additional information will be made available on the State Labor Department website. In weather tonight, partly cloudy north and mountains, otherwise clear with winds calming, very cold overnight with lows 13 below in the north to 13 above in the south. Tomorrow, partly cloudy north, mostly sunny in the south. Central Maine Power is turning to an old hand in its efforts to prop up its sagging reputation. David Flanagan, the company's CEO in the 1990s, will take over again, this time as executive chairman of the company's board. Fred Bever has more.
In the early 1990s, CMP also struggled with poor consumer confidence. Flanagan helped to turn that around, and he led its response to the 1998 ice storm. Now 72, Flanagan says his mission is much the same,
which is to restore public trust in an organization that is critical to the well-being and success of the people of Maine.
Flanagan spoke in a truck bay at CMP's Portland Depot. His ascension comes at a time when the company's botched rollout of a new billing system helped to drive its reputation to one of the lowest among utilities in the nation. And it comes as CMP seeks permits and public support for a potentially lucrative plan to build a new transmission corridor through western Maine to serve energy contracts with Massachusetts.
It's definitely not a game changer.
Representative Seth Berry, a Bodenham Democrat, co-chairs the legislature's Committee on Utilities, Energy, and Technology, an outspoken critic of CMP. Berry is leading an effort to explore the creation of a public transmission and distribution authority for Maine through a buyout of CMP and AmeriMaine's assets.
I wish Mr. Flanagan a lot of success, but it doesn't address the real issue facing the state of Maine, which is that in order to decarbonize and to improve our worst-than-nation reliability, we need low-cost capital and local control. And right now we have neither, and Mr. Flanagan's role will not bring either of those about.
In his newly created position, Flanagan will report to Avangrid Networks, a U.S. company whose majority owner is Iberdrola, a Spain-based energy giant. Flanagan says he is taking the job with assurances that he will have the authority to improve CMP's performance. And he says there are distinct advantages that come with being part of a larger enterprise.
And having a relationship, an affiliation with a regional company that can help us lower the cost of poles and wires and other things that we need to have, sharing some back office services, those are very valuable things.
Some observers say Flanagan's hiring demonstrates the parent company's late realization that CMP is in trouble. He has been hailed not just for his work during the ice storm, but also for making the decision to close the main Yankee nuclear power plants and a one-year stint as president of the University of Southern Maine, during which he closed a severe budget shortfall. Tony Buxton is an energy lawyer who represents an influential group of big energy users called the Industrial Energy Consumers Group. Buxton says Flanagan proved himself an adept leader when he steered CMP through a state-mandated divestiture of its energy generation assets, and he says autonomy will be key to Flanagan's success.
It is a challenge. It's an international company, not a local company, and therein lies a big difference. But David Flanagan does not need to be doing what he has agreed to do, and I'm sure he has had this discussion with Avangrid. He's not doing this for money, he's doing it for Maine.
Flanagan says he is well aware that it's not only CMP's reputation at stake, but his own.
I understand there are risks, but to me, those risks are worth taking to try to make things better.
Flanagan says he will not be responsible for managing CMP's controversial bid to build a transmission line through Western Maine. That project, he says, will be overseen by a separate management team. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
Ice harvesting was a thriving industry in 19th century New England. Using large, jagged-toothed saws, workers would cut heavy blocks from frozen rivers, lakes, and ponds, pack it in sawdust, and sell it around the world. Then came electric refrigeration. Ice cutting became obsolete, except in a few places where the tradition is carried on. From Maine Public Radio, Susan Sharon has more.
It's a postcard-perfect winter scene, a small snow-covered pond framed by tall trees and a rustic barn. Here in South Bristol, Maine, Ken Lincoln and several other men are out early in the morning doing what they learned to do as kids.
Cut that next one.
This one right here?
Yeah.
They're removing the first blocks of ice from the pond. Lincoln is the president of the Thompson Ice House Preservation Corporation, which operates an on-site museum and sponsors the old-fashioned ice harvest every President's Day weekend. He wears thick coveralls and ice grippers on his boots. This is slippery work.
Every year, somebody ends up in the pond, but no tragedies. We grab them out pretty quick.
Yeah. Steve, take them two and go that way out.
First, a checkerboard-style design is carved onto the pond's surface using a tool called a scribe. Then, volunteers use handsaws and ice picks to break off the blocks one row at a time. People of all ages are encouraged to participate.
Because you want to be careful.
9-year-old Isaac Ezell is helping his father, James, guide the ice blocks along an open channel of water toward the ice house, where they will be stored.
I was doing this since I was 6.
You did it before you were 6? I think we had you here when you were 4 for your first time.
Yeah.
Lincoln himself grew up skating on the pond. He also learned traditional ice harvesting techniques. And when he got older, worked for a small commercial ice operation that ended several decades ago.
If we didn't do this, it would go away and be forgotten. And this is one way to keep it a working history.
By mid-morning, a crowd has gathered. The 250-pound ice blocks are pushed up a wooden ramp and hoisted by pulley into the ice house, which is insulated with several inches of sawdust. The ice blocks glide in like giant high-speed hockey pucks. Energetic wranglers dodge the heavy blocks, spear them with long picks, and stack them one layer at a time until the ice house is nearly full.
It's very scary to watch.
Karen Pride is from Portland.
You can see that if something did not go right, it would be very bad.
Outside, Joanna Gavro and Justin Smith of Portland are sitting in heated folding chairs, eating chili and chowder, and watching three generations of volunteers take part in the effort. In the past, the couple have helped out, but Gavro says this year they were concerned about the thickness of the ice.
It looked a little slippery, a little thin, and I don't have the greatest balance, so we thought we'd just be more spectators this year.
But support and spirit.
This year, the ice is about 9 inches thick. That's several inches less than normal. But Ken Lincoln says winter seems to be arriving a little later each year. Still, it's enough ice to sell to local fishermen and boaters and to save for a popular ice cream social in July. More importantly, Lincoln says, it's a way to keep this chapter of New England history frozen in time. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org and join us tomorrow on Maine Calling at 1 o'clock, where we'll look at the serious obstacles facing working-class Americans. I'm Nora Flaherty.